So we are jumping into, we have a couple of items left in Perek Tet, chapter 9, which is where we're still up to. Does everybody see the share screen? Excellent. Okay. We started looking at this last week. We had a discussion about the overall theme of tshuva and vidui, and the sense of what Daniel's mission is in this critical tefillah, the critical moment in history that he saw, and the necessity of expressing on behalf of all of Israel, so to speak, sense of Kabbalat Adin, Tzidduk Adin, acceptance of the decree of the exile, and now a sense of a turning point for them and their loyalty to God. And there's much to unpack there further than what we did last week. But nonetheless, I want to move on as well. I will just make an observation that there is at the end of this parak, well, I didn't get to last week, I'd meant to, there is this sense that not only is his request a sense of built around the sense of, make sure that I am recording. Yes. Not only is it a sense built on the sense of tshuva and tzidduk hadin, but there's also a sense of recognition that there is a kind of existential chilul Hashem that exists by the state of the city of God in ruin. And he talks about in Pasuk Tetzayin, Kachot Sikotcha, Shavna Abchava Chamatcha Me'ercha Yishlam HaKotchecha, God should remove his anger from his city. Because the city, Yerushalayim, and God's people have become a source of shame to all of the people around us. And there is an element of, or the argument of, the Chilul Hashem factor in our exile. Moshe, in his defense of Israel after Chetah Egel, uses a similar argument. Ma Yamu Mitzrayim, what will Mitzrayim say? This is more intense because it's after the destruction, and essentially what Daniel is referring to here is reflected in more detail in a parak in Yechezkel, which we read as a Haftorah as well, in which Yechezkel describes the state of the Jewish people in exile as a kind of existential chilul Hashem. Because the nations of the world will look at Israel and say, this is the nation of God. They carry God's name, so to speak, and yet they have been exiled from their land. It's a parak in Yechezkel. It's a very powerful parak, and therefore Yechezkel describes the redemption of Israel being driven by that sense of chilul Hashem. And that is also a little bit reflected here in Daniel's comment about, or reference to, Yushalayim ve'amcha l'cherpa l'chol svivotenu. We've become a source of shame or reproach to all of the nations around us. And that's sort of, there's much more to unpack there. I'd meant to do it last week. We didn't get to it, but I'm going to, for now, just leave it as a reference. And it's on the source page from last week as well, if anybody has that reference still. It's in Yechezkel Perek Lamed Vav, chapter 36. It's read as a Haftorah, and you're welcome to look at it. You can see the connection is somewhat self-explanatory. All right, I've posted the sources here for anybody who's just joining us, and we are moving into the last piece of the of this discussion on Perek of the Tefillah. And then, Bezrat Hashem, next week we will move on to the latter part of the chapter. There's one more theme in this parak that I think we need to recognize, and it sort of takes us into a whole different direction, which is a kind of a tangent, if you will, which is not uncommon in the world of Tanakh study, but it's nonetheless very important for us to understand. What Daniel does in this tefillah is, in addition to everything we've talked about up until now in terms of tshuva and vidui and contrition and tachanunim, he introduces us to a concept which we don't necessarily always pay attention to. Because we live in a world or in a perspective where because we're in a kind of post-Tanakh perspective, where all of the themes have kind of all been integrated into Jewish life, and we don't necessarily unpack the levels of or the stages in which these themes are expressed to us. And so what Daniel does here, which is somewhat unique, is he reorients us to the status of Yerushalayim. And I want to explain what I mean by that. We start back in Pasuk, let's go back to Pasuk Zayin. L'cha Hashem atzdaka v'lanu boshet ha'panim, God, to you belongs righteousness, to us is shame. For the people of Judah and the inhabitants of Yerushalayim, and all of the people near and far, and to all the people in the lands to whom you have exiled them. Hashem lanu boshet ha'panim, and this is part of that vidui which we talked about. And then let's jump to Pasuk Yud Aleph, or Yud Bet. God has confirmed upon us all that he said he would against us and our judges and our leaders. To bring upon us such evil as not had been done. As that which was done in Yerushalayim. And then a little bit further, he says the following. You, God, who took us out of Egypt with a strong hand and a strong and outstretched arm, we have sinned. Hashem, k'chol tzidkotecha, in accordance with your righteousness, yashovna apacha b'chamatcha mi'ircha Yerushalayim, retract, pull back your anger from your city, Yerushalayim, har kodshecha, your holy mountain, yivachata'enu v'avanot avoteinu, Yerushalayim, because Yerushalayim and your people have become a source of shame in the world. And now listen to your prayer and the supplication of your servant. Shine your face upon the sanctuary which has been destroyed, the Mikdash. God, hear and see our destruction. The city upon whom you have placed, which you have placed your name. Not because of our righteousness, but because of your great compassion. Hashem slach, shmas, Hashem slach, Hashem akshiva, God forgive, God attend, God defer, don't delay, l'mancha lokai, for your sake, kishimcha nikra al ircha v'al amecha, because your name has been placed upon your city and upon your people. And if we pay attention carefully to the number of times Daniel mentions Yerushalayim, either by name or as a description of your city, al ircha ve'al amecha. It's intense, and it emphasizes, in fact, he only mentions the Mikdash once, ha'er panecha mikdashcha hashamim. But he mentions Yerushalayim as a city, and the shemama, the desolation, and the destruction of the city upon whom God's name has been placed, and the city which is identified with the people, ircha v'al amecha. In fact, I went through a quick exercise here in Al Torah. Our Al Torah has an interesting tool called Ma'abadat Tanakh. It's kind of a word laboratory on Tanakh. You can take any parak and play with it, just to see the number of times Yerushalayim is referred to, which is in this passage, which is 5. And if you add the 3 references to the city of Yerushalayim, you have a total of 8 references in the span of 7 or 8 psukim, which is really extraordinary and out of character in terms of the number of times a particular, right? The reference here, the subject, if you look at the Mikdash, is referenced once or twice. The notion here, the emphasis is clearly on the centrality of Yerushalayim. And that may not necessarily surprise us because we have such an association with Yerushalayim and the Mikdash and the story and that it kind of all forms a mishmash. In fact, if we look back at the description of the Daniel's Tefillah back in chapter 6, when we talked about the significance of Daniel facing Yerushalayim, and there it talks about the fact that Daniel faced Yerushalayim even though the Mikdash was destroyed. Remember that whole discussion about direction of Tefillah? Right, the chiddush here being, the novelty here being, that he felt there was a status to Yerushalayim, even if the Mikdash had been destroyed and his focus was on Yerushalayim. And that necessarily doesn't surprise us because we kind of link it all together, you know, the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael and the sanctity of Yerushalayim, etc. But they're really separate and they're really, if in terms of the development of the status of Yerushalayim there and the Mikdash, they are really independent of each other. And in order to really process how significant this is, I want to take you on a slight digression today and introduce you to a theme which we went through. For anybody who is in my course on Sefer Shmuel, we talked about this a lot in the context of our study of Sefer Shmuel. What was the status, the uniqueness of Yerushalayim? When did Yerushalayim attain its status and why did it attain its status? We are so used to connecting Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash, Har HaBayit, and the sanctity therein, we don't always necessarily realize that they are in fact two separate things and they source themselves in two separate elements or stories. And I want to highlight that here because Daniel shifts our attention specifically to the status of Yerushalayim and its connection to the people in his tefillah. So our journey is going to start with Psukim in Chumash. And again, does everybody have a copy of the source page? If you don't, again, I'm just going to post it here in the chat. If anybody just logged on after I posted it. Okay. For the most of these sources, I'm going to work with Ala Torah, which is an easier website to navigate, but they're all on the source page. So Dvarim Yud Bet, I'm just going to pull it off here on the website, but you have access to it as well. The story of Yerushalayim ostensibly begins in Chumash, in the description of a designated place that God will choose in which to place the Mikdash. And so you find Psukim like, and Dvarim Yudbet Pasukhei, rather than bringing your sacrifices on every hill and in every location, ki ima lamakom ashi yivchav Hashem alakichem mikol shivtechem lasun et shmo sham, to that place which God will choose to place his name there, there you will seek his divine presence. There you will come. And there you will bring your sacrifices and your offerings. There you will bring all of the various offerings. And there you will eat your sacrifice. There you will rejoice before God. You shall not do it, that which we do today. Today we all bring sacrifices whatever we want. Rather, that's because we haven't yet reached our land, the land of Israel. We'll cross over the Jordan. We will settle in the land which God will give us. The place which God will choose to place his name there, Shama Taviu Kol Asher Anochi Mitzaveh Etchem, there you will bring all that I command you. So the reference here over and over and over again to the place that God will choose from amongst all the tribes of Israel to place his name there, Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokechem V'Shaken Shmo Sham, that's exactly what Daniel referred to in his reference to the city, Ha'ir Asher Shimcha Nikra Al Yerchavi Al Amecha, that God's name was placed upon this city, and in that sense permanently, this is a reference to the place that the Torah describes, except for the fact that there's one problem, which is the Torah does not name the city. The Torah talks about the fact that there will be a place that God will choose from amongst all the tribes to place his name there, and there that will be the place of sacrifices. That will be the place of the Mishkan or the Mikdash. That will be the place of the Shekhinah, the Shaken Shmosham. Is it necessarily so that this place in this parak is Yerushalayim? If it is, then why not just say so? The Torah is not adverse to identifying the names of cities that will play a significant role. It talks about in Sefer Dvarim, in this parasha, it talks about the city of Shechem and the mountains of Hagrizim and Hareval and other places. Why suddenly the go around and language, Makom, Asheiv, Chara, Shemalok, Echem, Bola, Sheken, Shmosham, unless the place had not yet been determined, right? The place where the Mishkan would be several places. We'd have the Mishkan in Gilgal, we have the Mishkan in Nov, we have the Mishkan in Shiloh, we have the Mishkan in many places. And any one of them where the Mishkan was a place that God chose for that moment amongst the tribes to place his name there. There's nothing in this passage that says that this is a permanent place and that this is an eternal city. This is a city, whichever city it is, that is chosen to be the place of the Mishkan, of the place of L'Shaken Shmoshem. So even though we have a sense that it's a kind of reference to that designation of Yerushalayim, that's because we live in a world of hindsight. In the pshat of Chumash, at this moment, the place is not identified, it's not named, and it could be referring to any place where the Mishkan was. It doesn't necessarily have to be a reference to Yerushalayim at all. So where is Yerushalayim in the story? As I said, for close to 500 years, we lived in Israel. Yerushalayim was not the place of the Mishkan. The Mishkan sat in all kinds of other locations, from Gilgal to Nov to Shiloh to Gibeon to Nov, all kinds of different places. In fact, and if I were to say, if I were to ask you a priori, let's just stop here. I'm going to stop sharing for 1 second. If I were to say to you a priori, where does the story of Yerushalayim begin? I'm sure you would all point to Sefer Bereishit.
Abraham.
Right? Abraham?
Abraham.
Who wouldn't? I see Asher shaking his head. Hang on a second. Right? Who wouldn't point to Yusha, to Avraham, to the Akedah, to Har Moriah, to right?
Yerushalayim before.
Excuse me?
Yerushalayim
before. So again, I'll come back to that in a second. Except that, from a pshat perspective, the places in Sefer Bereishit are not clearly identified. Shalem, as an example, Makitzedek Melech Shalem, which by the Masorah of the Medrash is connected to Yerushalayim, from a pshat perspective, may be a reference to Shechem. Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Ir Shechem. Malki Tzedek may not be associated with Yerushalayim at all. The reference to the Akedah on Eretz HaMoriah is, so that's about as close as we have, because we know where Eretz HaMoriah or Zohar HaMoriah is. But again, Yerushalayim as a name of a city is not mentioned. Nor is the place where Yaakov had his famous vision of the ladder, which is described as Beit El. And again, we have all of the mystery, the story of the Evan Ashtiyah, the foundation stone from which the world was created. They're all midrashic. There is no clear reference to Yerushalayim as a central motif in Sefer Bereishit. Furthermore, I would argue that even if I accept, and I do accept, the Masorah, that all of these things are connected to Yerushalayim, what is clear is that they may have taken place or been connected to Yerushalayim historically, but we don't know that until 500 years later in hindsight. When David HaMelech brings the Aron to Yerushalayim and conquers Yerushalayim as the capital city of Israel, I'll show you that in a moment, he has absolutely no idea where the place of the Mikdash is going to be. He has no idea of any of the connections between Yerushalayim and the stories of Sefer Breshit. It is simply a Masoret that does not exist. In Tehillim, David spends a great deal of time talking about the fact that he was searching for a place in which to build the Mikdash. His choice of Yerushalayim had nothing to do with the Masoret of the Avot. And so whatever Masoret of the Avot existed, that is independent of and unknown to the story of Yerushalayim and the people at the time. Where the Yerushalayim takes on its significance is in the story of David HaMelech. And so that's where I want to start our journey into understanding what Yerushalayim represented, and therefore the questions that we need to ask ourselves. So for this, let's go back to our sharing. And I want to jump to, here's an interesting thing. This I'm going to do in the source page because it's just easier. Before I do that in the source page, these psukim in Shmuel Bet, we'll pull up here. At what point does Yerushalayim take on the status of the capital of Israel, or the central city in the life of our people Israel? And the answer is Shmuel Bet Parakeh. You want to understand when Yerushalayim takes on its unique status, it enters into the conversation only in Shmuel Bet Parakeh. There, the Pasuk says that, and this I'm just going to do a quick review of what's going on. Perek Hay of Shmuel Bet is in the aftermath of a series of very difficult events post the death of Saul. If you remember, Saul's death leaves a void because David had been promised that he would be the next king of Israel, but the people of Benjamin and all of the tribes of the north didn't accept David as their king. They saw Saul as the legitimate king, and therefore the son of Saul, who survives the battle of Har Gilboa, namely Ishbosheth, is given the throne of Israel. And Shaul's general, Avner, fights on behalf of Ishbosheth. And what emerges is a very dramatic civil war between David's loyal army from tribe of Judah and Shaul's army, in the context of Ishbosheth, from the tribe of Benjamin and north. And all of that is really starts in Perek Bet, Pasuk Chet, if you will, Avner ben Ner Sarat Sava Shirla Shaul Akach Ishboshet ben Shaul Vyavareu Machanaim. Avner ben Ner took Ishboshet, son of Shaul, took him over to the city of Machanaim, made him king, anointed him as king, Vayim Lechay Val Gilad, Vial Ashuri, Vial Yisrael, Vial Ephraim, Vial Binyamin, Vial Yisrael Kulo, and over all of Israel. And he was 40 years old, and he was new king of Israel, whereas Beit Yehuda hayu achrei David. But the tribe of Judah was loyal to David. And there was a great war that took place between the forces of Avner and the force loyal to Ishbosheth and the forces of Yoav loyal to David. And that war went on for some time. We forget the fact that David emerges as the king of Israel only after an extraordinary civil war that tore the country apart and that was threatened to create a permanent rift between Binyamin and everybody to the north and David and Shevet Yehudah to the south. I will remind everybody, do a quick look at the map, that right, Binyamin is north of from Binyamin north is a Binyamin, Ephraim, Manasseh, Gad, all the tribes of Israel. Judah is to the south, and essentially the rift between Shaul and David is a rift here along the line of Shevet Yehudah and everybody else north. And that's what David is faced with. He fights this battle on the one hand. On the other hand, it is tearing the people apart. How this war comes to an end, I won't go into. It's complicated. But in chapter 5, Vayavok kol shivtei Yisrael al David Chevrona. After Ishbosheth dies, the war is over. The tribes of Israel in the north come to David in Chevron, and they say to him, Ininu atzmecha uvisarcha anachnu. We are your bone and your flesh. Gam etmol, we've been loyal to you. We know that you have been the general. You have been loyal. You have been the leader. We are coming. V'tatiel nagida Yisrael. We want you to become king over all of Israel. They make a covenant in Chevron. And they anoint David as king over all of Israel. Then he was 30 years old. He reigned for 40 years. In Chevron, he reigned for 7 years, which means that the civil war had gone on for 7 years, just to put in perspective. And Yerushalayim, we haven't gotten to Yerushalayim yet. We'll see in a second. The first thing David does as the newly appointed king over all of Israel, the very first act of David as king over all of Israel is Vayelech HaMelech Vanashav Yerushalayim Ela Yevusi Yoshev HaAretz. And the king went to Yerushalayim, to the Jebusites of Yerushalayim, who were the inhabitants of the land. And this phrase here is the key phrase to understanding the turmoil that David found himself in and what he did to address it. And I want to explain and unpack this story. And what proceeds in the rest of the perek is the conquest of Yerushalayim. If anybody's ever taken a tour to Ir David, you have at some point or another been through the tunnels, and you understand the challenges to conquer Yerushalayim and what David does to conquer Yerushalayim. I'm not going into any of that. It's not relevant to our discussion. Other than to recognize that up until this point in time, Yerushalayim is a Jebusite city. Now we're 500 years into the Israelite settlement of the land of Israel. And I will simply put it thus. If in fact Yerushalayim had some kind of long-standing Masorah tradition significance in Jewish history, can you imagine for yourself living in the land of Israel for 500 years, and this is the first time anybody's ever heard of Yerushalayim as a Jebusite city, the totally neglected by the Jews? In fact, if we turn the clock back 500 years, and we go to, or 400 years, and we go to Yeshua in the beginning, when they first enter into the land of Israel, we find that the city of Yerushalayim had in fact been conquered twice. Once in the time of Yeshua, once in the time of Shoftim, or at least referenced to the entrance to Yerushalayim, but never settled. And the Pesukim in Yoshua are really quite astounding. The Pasuk says, the cities, tribal cities of Judah were identified in Yoshua Perek Tetvav, all the names of all the cities that were given to the tribe of Judah. And one of those cities is the Ketef HaYevusi Minegev HiYerushalayim, is the hilltop of Yerushalayim, the shoulder of the Jebusites in the south. But the Jebusites dwelt in Yerushalayim, Vayevusi Yoshvei Yerushalayim, and therefore lo yachlu b'nei Yehuda l'risham, b'nei Yehuda were unable to settle Yerushalayim. And so Vayeshev Vayevusi b'nei Yehuda b'Yerushalayim, the Jebusites continued to dwell in Yerushalayim amidst the tribe of Judah. And so the picture we get at the end of Yeshua Tetzvah is simply that they tried, were unable, and the Jebusites continued to live in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is not significant enough, or Yerushalayim was not conquered by the tribe of Judah, or it was conquered and unsettled, unclear. But it's certainly a Jebusite city by the time this is finished. In Yeshua Perek Yud Chet, we have a list of the tribes of Binyamin. And in the list of the tribes of Binyamin, it says, Bitzela ha'elef v'hayibusi hi Yerushalayim, that the list of Yerushalayim included as a Yerushalayim as a city to the tribe of Binyamin. In the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, we have the following verse. B'nei Binyamin were unable to remove the Jebusites from Yerushalayim. And so the Jebusites continued to dwell in Yerushalayim amidst the B'nai Binyamin, the tribe of Binyamin, until this day. Anybody struck by the oddity of these two verses? Right? You have virtually the identical verse in Yeshua Tadvav Samach Gimel. The Jebusites dwelt in Yerushalayim amongst B'nai Yehuda, and Shoftim Perek Aleph, which is the Jebusites dwelt in Yerushalayim amidst B'nai Binyamin. So to ask the question simply, to whom was the city of Yerushalayim given? Was it given to the tribe of Judah, or was it given to the tribe of Binyamin? And the answer is very simple.
Binyamin.
The answer is?
It was split.
It was less split than it was given to both.
No, it was the border for both. It was a marker.
Okay, like, so let me
you describe to us the place.
Hang on a second, Rabasha. Let me qualify this. We draw maps with lines. In Tanakh, they don't draw maps with lines. There are no lines drawn on tribal territory. What there are cities, and the cities are assigned to tribe A or tribe B. There are, and they're not insignificant, a number of cities that are attributed to two tribes, Yerushalayim being one of them. It's not the only one. So you could say it's a marker in between, but somewhere along the line, you have to decide to whom does it belong. Because once Yeshua, on a global scale, finishes the conquest on a national scale of securing the strategic control of the land of Israel, what he does next is he assigns each tribe to go and conquer and settle their territory. So who was assigned to go and conquer Yerushalayim? The answer is Yehuda and Binyamin. And that's problematic because neither does. And the reason neither does is very simple. Because if you look at Yerushalayim, this is a picture of Yerushalayim in the time of David. It's an artistic drawing of Yerushalayim at the time of David. But you get a sense of what the challenge was. Yerushalayim was a fortress on top of a hill, surrounded by valleys on all sides. And the Jebusites lived here in a walled city. And the tribe of Binyamin looked at this and said, "Ooh, that's a very hard city to conquer. Judah, you can have it." And the tribe of Judah looked at this and said, "Oh, that's a very hard city to conquer. That's a lot of effort. Binyamin, you can have it." And the end result was that the Jebusites continued to live in Yerushalayim, whether in the tribe of Binyamin, whether in the tribe of Judah, the text says they lived in Yerushalayim amidst both. Because, as we pointed out, Yerushalayim sits on the what we would call the border or the in-between, meaning it's assigned to both tribes, Judah in the south, Binyamin in the north. But the bottom line of it is, the takeaway is, nobody cared enough about Yerushalayim to go and conquer it. It was simply abandoned. And it was so abandoned that at the end of the period of Shoftim, we're now talking about, we're getting to the history of Sefer Shoftim, it gets complicated, but there's a story at the end of the book of Shoftim, which is called Pilagash Begiva. If you've studied the story, you know. If you haven't studied the story, you've been spared the anguish of one of the most difficult stories in Tanakh. There is a story of a Levi and his Pilagash, and they're heading north from Beit Lechem towards they're heading north into the area of Ephraim. And they come on their journey at nighttime to Yevus, which is Yerushalayim. Hemem Yevus, v'hayom rad ma'od, they get to Yevus and the city is setting. So the Nara says to his master, to the Levi, l'chana v'nasud el ha'ir ha'yevusi azot. Let's go and settle in, let's go and sleep in this Jebusite city, referring to Yerushalayim. Now, we're not going there. That's an Ir Nochri. That's a Gentile city. It's not of Israelite. They won't be nice to us. And so they end up going to Giva of Binyamin. And if anybody knows the story of Pelegish Begiva, you know that it doesn't end well for them, because the people of Giva were far less hospitable than perhaps the people of the Jebusites in Yerushalayim might have been to them. But the notion of Yerushalayim as a Jebusite city, all the way at the time of the end of the period of Shoftim, means that for all of those hundreds of years, nobody cared enough about Yerushalayim to conquer it until David. And David does so, for a very simple reason. It's self-evident. David went to Yerushalayim because at the moment of the conflict between the tribe of Binyamin and the tribe of Yerushalayim, the question that he faced was, when you unite the tribes of Israel under one banner, under one leadership, under one malchus, where do you put your capital? Where do you put your flag in the ground? If he placed his flag in the ground in Hebron, up until that period of time, in all of the book of Shoftim, every shofet, every leader of every tribe, placed his leadership role, his central capital, in a hometown of his tribe, Gidon in Ophrah and Divtzan in Bethlehem, wherever their central city of their tribe was, because leadership was tribal. That's the primary definition between the leadership at the time of Malchus and the leadership of the time of the Shoftim, whether tribal leadership is tribal or national. David at this moment was faced with the challenge, for the very first time in history, to unite the two warring sections of Israel, Binyamin and Judah, into one united people. To do so, he felt it necessary to move his capital. Where did he move it to? Simple. He moved it to no man's ground, no man's land. Yerushalayim was completely abandoned. Yerushalayim was no man's land. It was on the border between Yerushalayim and Binyamin. It had been unclaimed by Binyamin, unclaimed by Yehuda, and it could place the border of Israel, it could place the capital of Israel in a way that was identified by both. And it's not unprecedented, at least maybe this was the precedent, but in the course of history, many times in which capital cities are chosen because they sit on the border between various groups that we want to unite into one capital or into one country. Canada, Washington, D.C. in America all had a similar kind of history. And that's exactly what David does with Yerushalayim. So to make it very clear, David doesn't choose Yerushalayim because it has a very long history of spiritual anchor that goes all the way back to the Avot, etc. David chooses Yerushalayim for one simple reason. It was his way of uniting the tribes of Israel. That's David's agenda, to bring all the tribes together under one banner. It's no man's land. It's between the warring factions of the tribes. It will be the city. Now, that point, it becomes, right, what does he do next? Is he moves the Aron, right, after he conquers Yerushalayim after he conquers Yerushalayim in Perek Bet, the very first thing he does next is he begins the process of moving the Aron to Yerushalayim, because once we have a permanent house, once we have a permanent place, once we have a capital, then you can talk about in Perek Vav moving the Aron to Yerushalayim and making that the place for the Mikdash, because everything he does now is to solidify his kingdom, is to solidify the Malchus. And so the identification of Yerushalayim is the place where the Aron will come in order to establish what will become the Mikdash, is connected to the fact that he's chosen Yerushalayim as the city to unite the tribes of Israel.
Rabbi, is there also a reason to unite the kids of Rachel and the kids with Leah?
I don't think... is that playing a role in David's mind? No, I don't think so. I think that there's a lot of second layer conversations about it, but I don't... it's not. I don't think that's a conscious effort on David's part. I think that it plays out in different ways. There's a conscious and a subconscious or an overt intention in his case, and then there's the hashgacha that's happening around it. That's sort of how Tanakh operates on two levels. So does he achieve the unification of the tribes of Israel? Yes. What that means for us, we'll see momentarily.
Some of us on the call have kind of cheated because we heard in Ivrit on Torah and Moshe a few weeks ago an excellent shiur by Rabbi Yoel Binun on the subject.
Correct.
If I recall correctly, he did like the idea of the rivalry between Rachel and Leah playing a role.
That's
somebody else can correct me.
Right. It's entirely possible. I don't think it's not a role. I just don't think it's functioning in David's conscious mind. I think David's functionality, or David's role here, is driven by an intent to unite the tribes. That's my personal opinion.
Isn't there a practical reason that he, after all his troubles marrying Saul's daughter and still not being made king, Ishbosheth, that he needed a safe, fortified city? That he doesn't, this way he doesn't have, every time there's trouble, run to the Plishtim or run here or run there. There is a practical reason for taking the one of the best fortified cities in the land.
Again, I don't see it that way. And the reason I don't see it that way is because there's so much, nobody challenges David at this point. They've come to David in embraced in open arms. Avner, the people, the leaders. I don't see David, he'll deal with the Plishtim, but he still has to war with the Plishtim even after Yerushalayim. But I don't think his focus here, till many, many years later, in the aftermath of the Bathsheba, which we'll get to in a second, I don't think he is concerned about Yerushalayim. I don't think he goes to Yerushalayim because he is concerned for himself. I see it much more as his effort, primary effort, which is to unite the tribes of Israel together. Whether that's a Rachel Leah split, a rift, one can argue, but I think his primary agenda is to unite the tribes of Israel together. Give me a few minutes. Let me just move this forward because I want to make sure we get to the main thesis, which is to connect us back to the Neo-Perek Tet, which we'll do in a moment. Where this has, and you may have discussed this with Rabbi Binun, it's entirely possible. Much of what I am sharing with you appears in both of Binun's writings as well as in Rav Meidan's writings. But I will show with you, and this may, Binun probably did address, one of the most dramatic moments where we see the connection between Yerushalayim to the sense of unity that the tribes have around David's Malchus is in Malachim Aleph Perek Yud Aleph. When the kingdom eventually is split apart again, and we're now talking 80 years later or more, right, after Shlomo Melech, in the time of Rehavam ben Shlomo, when the kingdom will eventually be split apart, there is a very famous nevuah of Melech in of Achiah Shilani, and there he talks to this upstart who will start the rival northern kingdom. Again, it's years later. Excuse me? Yerovam ben Nevat, correct. And there Yerovam ben Nevat encounters the Navi Achiah Shilani, and Achiah Shilani does the following. He takes a garment, whose garment it is not our issue for now, and he tears it into 10 pieces. And he says to Yerovam ben Nevat, Kach lecha asarak kraim, you take 10 pieces, Komar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Inini Karei Atam Lamlacha Miyad Shlomo, V'natati Lecha Tasra Shvatim. You take 10 pieces because I'm going to tear 10 tribes away from Shlomo and give them to you. V'yashevet ha'echad yelo leman avdi David, uleman Yerushalayim ha'ir asher bacharti ba mikol shivtei Yisrael. And one portion will be given to my servant David and his descendants for the sake of David and for the sake of Yerushalayim. So the Mefarshim all struggle with the math because I have 12 tribes. I've given 10 to Yerovam ben Nevat, and I've given one to the southern kingdom. So they all identify the fact that this must be a reference to Yehuda and Binyamin. Because when the kingdom is eventually split, Binyamin stays annexed to the southern kingdom of Judah. as much as that is an unnatural fault line. And here I would agree with Rabbi Nun's idea that it, to put Binyamin into the southern kingdom of Judah is an unnatural fault line. The natural fault line is between Yehuda and the children of Rachel. The unnatural fault line is Binyamin annexed to Yehuda. The Navi here says explicitly, I will give 10 tribes to you from Ephraim northward, because Yehovam ben Nevat is from Shevet Ephraim, and one tribe to Judah, one tribe for David. Problem, of course, is that that leaves 11 tribes, and I have 12. And so the Mefarshim, and I shared with you the text of the Mefarshim, you have it on the source page, the Mefarshim all say that that one tribe refers to Yehuda and Binyamin together. Why would one tribe refer to Yehuda and Binyamin together? So this I heard from a Medan, I think it's in the name of Avyal, that the way you read this text is the phrase, Ashevet Ha'echad, is what the Mefarshim referred to as Moshech Atzmo Ve'acharim Imo. You have to read it twice. Namely, one tribe I've given to the southern kingdom for the sake of David, and one tribe for the sake of Yerushalayim. Shevet Echad Yelo Leman Avdi David, Ve'ashevet Ha'echad Yelo Leman Yerushalayim. Meaning, which is a very common structure in Tanakh, Mefarshim speak about this a lot, Ibn Ezra in particular. What do I achieve by that? I achieve by that an understanding of why the southern tribe of Binyamin is annexed to the southern kingdom. No, the tribe of Binyamin is annexed to the southern kingdom because, where's my map? Because in order to maintain Yerushalayim and the Mikdash in Yerushalayim as the seat of David and as the capital of Israel, I can't allow Yerushalayim to fall back into the state of being a border city between two tribes. And so for the sake of Yerushalayim, it's necessary to annex Binyamin to the southern kingdom, which is an extraordinary change of history. Essentially, what I'm suggesting to you is, and this is going to bring us back to the story of Daniel in a second, God didn't choose Yerushalayim. David chose Yerushalayim. God chose David. And every reference to Yerushalayim in this story starts with, "I, for the sake of my servant David, and for the sake of Yerushalayim, the city whom I choose." But I didn't choose Yerushalayim. God chose David. David chose Yerushalayim to unite the tribes of Israel, and thereby God chose David as the seat of the throne in Yerushalayim. But it all revolves around this moment of David HaMelech. As they say in Hebrew, what's the punchline? The punchline is, in Shmuel Bet Perek Tetvav, years later, in the aftermath of the events, tragic events of David and Bathsheba, and the death of Uriah, and the consequence of the Nevuah of Natan, and the internal collapse of David's own household, Amnon and Tamar, if you're familiar with the story, eventually leading to the rebellion of Avshalom. And Avshalom starts an open, full-scale rebellion against David. Now, to understand, Avshalom starts his rebellion in Hebron, and he's marching on Yerushalayim. In Shmuel Perek Tedvav, Vahimeachrachen, Vayazl Avshalom Merkavav, Vesusim, Vechamishim Ish, Vatzim Lefanav, he takes his chariots and horses and 50 men, and he gets up and he takes all the people, and he's marching towards Yerushalayim. And jumping down to, he sends messengers and he says, when you hear the sound of the shofar, etc., you'll know that Malach Avshalom b'Chevron. Vayavam agid al David lemor, hayalev ish Yisrael achmei Avshalom. The people come to David and they say to David, the heart of Israel is with Avshalom. So David says to everybody who's with him in Yerushalayim, "Kumu v'nivracha, we are going to run. We're going to flee. Ki lo tiyeh lanu pleita mipnei Avshalom. We will have no rescue. We will no escape from the hands of Avshalom if we stay in Yerushalayim. Lo tiyeh lanu pleita. We will not survive. Ma'ul alechad pen yemeir b'yisagnu. We have to leave lest he catch us. B'diach alenu tara'av yika ilifichav. Lest he smite us by the edge of the sword. So his servants say to him, "Yomer Abdei Melech, Kol Hashiv Chal Adoni Melech Yine Avadecha. Whatever the king chooses, if you want to do this, so be it." You sense from their response that I don't think they agreed with the strategic analysis of David at that moment. Even though we're after the rebellion, and even though after Bathsheba, and even though the people are with Avshalom, as David leaves, he realizes how much of a loyal following he still has. He has the strategic position of Yerushalayim. There is no question from a strategic military perspective, Avshalom does not stand a chance against David and Yoav in Yerushalayim. From a military standpoint, there's no real threat to David in Yerushalayim at this moment. And yet David chooses to leave. Why he chooses to leave is a complicated question. He chooses to leave because he doesn't want blood on his hands. He doesn't want a civil war. He chooses to leave because he doesn't want he doesn't want the guilt of the story of Noah all over again. There's many reasons why he chooses to leave. We're not unpacking all of Sefer Shmuel at this moment, but he chooses to leave. And as he's leaving, the people come to him, Yoav comes with him, and the army goes with him, and the people of various groups come to him and say, express their loyalty. And then David says something extraordinary. Hinei gam Tzadok v'chol ha-Leviyim ito nosim et aron brit ha-Elokim. Tzadok and the Levites come, and they carried the Ark of the Covenant. Why do they carry the Ark of the Covenant? Because the Ark came to Yerushalayim, not because Yerushalayim had a unique status. The Ark came to Yerushalayim because David brought it to Yerushalayim. It was the Malchus of David that sat at the center of the story. Malchus of David was leaving. David was abandoning the throne. David was abdicating for Avshalom, for whatever reason. Not our issue for now. Eventually, he'll wage the war and come back. But at this moment in time, in Perek Tetzav, David is leaving Yerushalayim, and he's leaving behind the throne, and he's leaving it to Avshalom, but he takes the Aron with him because the Aron was his. He brought it to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim and all its significance revolves around the Aron and David. David chose the city. David turns at this moment, and he says, "Vayatziku et Aron Elokim," and he says to them, "Vayomer HaMelech leTzadok, Hashev et Aron Elokim ha'ir. Send the Aron back." And he sends the Aron back to Yerushalayim. He hands Avshalom the Aron with the Urim v'Tumim, with the secret communication with the Kohanim, with the abilities David had used the Aron throughout his wars to know where the enemy was, to seek God's guidance. He takes this secret weapon, this enormous power of the Aron, and he sends it back to Yerushalayim. And he says, If I find favor in God's eyes, he will bring me back and show me, and I will once again see the Aron and his habitation, his home, his place, the place of the Mikdash, ve'et naveu. Whereas if he says, "I do not desire you," let him do to me as it seems good to him. I will tell you, without getting into too much detail, because we have only 3 minutes left, in my study of Sefer Shmuel and my teaching of Sefer Shmuel, I think these are the two most dramatic psukim in David's life. Because what he does here is he accepts the totality of everything that has befallen him. He accepts the Kabbalat HaDin of God's judgment for the story of Bathsheba. He does not presuppose that he will ever return to the throne of Yerushalayim. He's given up that throne with the understanding that unless God, the circumstances change, God has essentially thrown him out of Yerushalayim. Absalom will sit on his throne. And the Aron won't stay with David. The Aron goes back to Yerushalayim. And what he does here is he separates for the very first time. He separates his malchus, his kingdom, his seed, his throne from the status of Yerushalayim as the place of God. Yerushalayim is here described as Naveu, the Nave, the habitation of the Shekhinah. That's David's Chiddush. David introduces it. He says, I, Melech Yisrael, I as King of Israel, I'm going into exile. But the Aron stays with Yerushalayim. Up until this point, the city was identified with the capital. If a kingdom falls, the capital shifts. If the kingdom fell to two warring armies, if one conquers the other and the kingdom falls, then the capital shifts to the capital of the other city, or the other, of the winning faction. Here, for the first time, David says, no, the Ark will stay in Yerushalayim for eternity. This is where Yerushalayim takes on an entirely new status. And that's, I think, ultimately what we are now looking at 500 years later in the story of Daniel. Daniel takes us for granted that Yerushalayim has a status of God's city, the city that God chose amongst the tribes of Israel to place his name there, is not just wherever the Mishkan is, but it's Yerushalayim. The Mishkan, the Mikdash can be destroyed. We're still in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is still the city that's identified with the Jewish people. It's still the city that carries God's name. It's an eternal. We talk about Yerushalayim as the eternal capital of Israel. It's only the eternal capital of Israel because David made it so. And David made it so in two dramatic moments. Moment number one was when he chose Yerushalayim to be the central capital city that would unite all the tribes of Israel, and refused flatly to fight with a brother, with his son, with the civil war over Yerushalayim. He was willing to literally give up his throne rather than to fight a civil war over Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was to be a symbol of unity forever. Was part one, and part two, more importantly, even when he went into exile, he says the Aron stays in Yerushalayim. The Ark, the symbol of God's presence, will remain forever in Yerushalayim in association with the city upon which God's name is. And that is essentially what Daniel, 500 years later, can articulate. The Mikdash is destroyed, was still facing Yerushalayim. Why? Because Yerushalayim is the place of God, not just the Mikdash, not just the temple, but the city of Yerushalayim established by David. That's essentially the link that ties all the pieces together. Then we can go back to the history of Sefer Bereishit. But the notion of Yerushalayim as the city of God's presence, that's expressed through the sacrifice that David makes by taking the Aron and essentially giving up his own throne in light of, or in lieu of, or in preference to the Mikdash and the Aron itself. I will just end with one more source, and that is the most famous parak about Yerushalayim articulated by David, or associated to David, which is Tehillim Perach Chavbet, Kuf Chavbet, Shira Ma'alot L'David, Song of Ascent, Samachti B'omim Li Beit Hashem Nelech, I rejoiced when they said, let us go to the house of God. Umdot Yudaklenu B'Sharayach Yerushalayim, my feet stood for the tribute of the Olei Yerushalayim, those who were going up to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim Habnuya Ki'ir Shechuva L'Yachdav, Yerushalayim built as a city that joins together. Much has been said, upper city, lower city, is that the reference here? Or is it the Achdus, the combination of the tribes of Israel that David represented in that moment when he chose Yerushalayim? Regardless, continues and says, Shesham Alu Shvatim Shifteka, there the tribes of Israel would go. There they would go to the temple. There they would give thanks. Shama Yashvu Kisot L'Mishpat, there sat the throne of judgment. Kisot Levet David, the throne. The thrones of the house of David. And therefore, Shalu Shalom Yerushalayim. That, I think, ultimately comes back to what Daniel kind of picks up on in the status of Yerushalayim. We say it in our tefillah every day. Yerushalayim ircha berachamim tashuv. In our tefillah, we say God should return to Yerushalayim, your city. Yerushalayim, from a shot perspective in Tanakh, Yerushalayim can be called ircha, your city. Daniel can call it al ircha, al amecha, because David chose to make Yerushalayim eternal, independent of whether he was associated with that city or not. That's sort of the takeaway. If I were to look at what we looked at in Sefer Shmuel, combine it with what we're doing in Sefer Daniel, that kind of brings the two pieces together. Okay, I've run out, actually over time, but we started a few minutes later, so I hope that's okay. I want to actually just reiterate what I said at the beginning of the shiur, which is that I have a small conflict in time next week. And so I think in order to make it work, I'm going to ask your indulgence to change the time of the shiur and start half an hour later. So we'll start next week at 12, or at 1:30 Central Time, Eastern Time, or 12:30 Central Time, which will be 8:30 Israel Time, just to put it in perspective. And if anybody has an issue, let me just put into the chat my email. Anybody has a concern with the time, please email me. Also, I will have a Torah in Motion send that out by email as well. So I thank you for that. And if anybody has questions, I have a few more minutes to stay online and ask questions. But officially, I'm going to end this year so people can log off.
I want to say something. Thank you very much. I'd like to say something inspired by your wonderful suggestion. You imply that Yerushalayim is Ir HaKodesh, because it has the Mishkan there, even when David is not there. It applies in our time, Yerushalayim is Ir HaKodesh, even though the Mashiach hasn't come yet.
100%. So the Rambam, right, from a halachic perspective, where this takes on status, is when the Rambam writes that the sanctity of Yerushalayim is independent of the Mishkan and the Mikdash and is eternal, because Yerushalayim is the place of the Shekhinah. And the Shekhinah lo zaza mimkoma, doesn't move. But that notion that the Shekhinah doesn't move from its place is not a foregone conclusion. The Shekhinah in Har Sinai moved to the Aron. The Shekhinah in the Mishkan moves all the time. The only reason the Shekhinah in Yerushalayim doesn't move is because David made a fundamental historical choice to say that the Aron stays in Yerushalayim permanently, and that that's the new permanent home of the Shekhinah. That's the uniqueness. So you're correct, but it's connected to the fact that that was a conscious decision, not necessary. And because it's a symbol of the unity of the tribes of Israel, I think that that's part of it. He's saying. The Shekhinah is now going to remain in Yerushalayim. It's not going to come with me. I'm going into exile. I'm going to sit in another city somewhere in Israel. And you're going to take the Shekhinah with me? No, the Shekhinah now has a home. The Jewish people have a home. Jewish people have a land. They have a kingdom. They have a malchus. They have a flag. They have a degel. They have a capital. We're not going to shift that every single time there's a transition in leadership. So that is a dramatic change, but I think it's driven by David.
This would also explain why David HaMelech had pity on Avshalom and didn't want Avshalom to be killed, because he didn't need Yerushalayim.
There's a lot to unpack in Sefer Shmuel. I teach Sefer Shmuel as a separate year. It's been a 5-year, 6-year effort. So I will. That's a complicated question to answer. But if you are interested in it, there's many shiurim I posted on the show website, and you can explore it. But it's a complicated piece. All right.
And can I make a suggestion? The pasuk you brought about the cloak being torn into 10 pieces plus one.
It's 10. My theory is that it's 10 plus 2, but okay. This I heard from my mentor.
No, I think it's 10 plus 1. Because David HaMelech is the leader of Yehuda. He rises to be the leader of Yehuda. When the northern kingdom separates out, they are separating out from Yehuda, with the exception of Binyamin. That is, Binyamin is torn away from the northern kingdom to be added to Yehuda. Yehuda is the entity. And I think it reads in that pasuk that you brought.
So the Mefarshim suggest that the one tribe there is a reference to Yehuda and Binyamin. But they don't address the question of the northern tribe is 10 tribes and is given 10 pieces. The southern tribe is 2 tribes and is given 1 piece. So what I'm suggesting is just a simple modification of how to read the pasuk. This I heard from Ephmedan, which is that he's given 2 tribes and therefore 2 pieces. The pieces represent the number of tribes, not the leadership. The northern kingdom, Yeravam, is given 10 pieces because he's been given 10 tribes. Shlomo has been given 2 pieces because he's been given 2 tribes, except that the pasuk lists it as one phrase that appears twice, or should appear twice, or is supposed to be read twice. Shevet Echad Leman David is a reference to Judah, and Shevet Echad Leman Yerushalayim is a reference to Binyamin. That's how Rav Mindan reads it. You could argue, but it's a it resolves the math issue, because otherwise there are 12 tribes and he only identifies 11 pieces, so it's a problem. So that this is a solution to the math issue of that text. Okay, thank you all for listening.
I didn't make myself clear. I was presenting a solution to the math issue, but okay. Think about it.
I hear you.
And look it up, because I think that it's quite clear that the separation of the northern part is from the entity that David had created. The tribe of Yehuda had become, that was the entity, and Rehoboam ben Nevat is basically tearing away everything from Yehuda. He's actually trying to tear away everything from Yehuda. But the Navi gives Yehuda back one tribe, Binyamin. That's how I see the math. But okay, listen. One has to
think carefully
at the language.
Either interpretation I think would work. One thing I will clarify, I see now in the chat, I don't know if Julian is still on the call, but we always ever talk about 12 tribes because Levi is not in the conversation. Anytime you talk about tribal territory, you're talking about Ephraim and Manasseh separate. Levi is scattered, and so Levi is not part. It doesn't have land. It's not part of the conversation. You only ever have 12 in the total picture of the tribes of Israel. So just to clarify that. All right, we're going to stop here. Thank you all for listening, and have a wonderful week. In Zat Hashem, next week, 1/2 hour later, we'll start at 1:30 New York time and do the math from there. Thank you.